I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. This morning, we talk about organ donations. Every 10 minutes, another name is added to the list of people waiting for organ or tissue donations, and many of these people will die if a donor is not found. This morning, we hear the story of a life-saving liver transplant and the bond that formed between the donor's mother and the organ recipient. We'll also talk with the president of the New England Organ Bank about how donors and recipients are matched. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, nearly 120,000 men, women, and children are currently in need of life-saving organ transplants, and an average of 18 people die each day from the lack of available organs for transplant. Individuals awaiting liver transplants are second in number only to those in need of kidney transplants, and as of this morning, the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network database had 15,798 people on a waiting list for liver transplants. Laura Welch was one of those individuals awaiting a liver transplant after 2 years on the list. An 18-year-old boy, A.J. Gibson, died from a blow to the head. He saved her life. In addition to his liver, six other of A.J.'s organs are living on in others. Laura Welch eventually contacted and met A.J.'s mother, Claudette, and the two formed a bond. Laura Welch is joining us this morning from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Good morning, Laurel.
Good morning.
And we're also expecting Claudette to arrive, hopefully any moment. Laura, let's talk about how you ended up on this list for a liver transplant.
Well, I'm a registered nurse, and back in the 80s, I had a blood exposure at the hospital in which I was working. But I really wasn't concerned about it because it was pre-universal precautions. We didn't use goggles, masks, or gloves. And the only thing that really bothered me was that I ruined my skirt. It was just, you know, an ordinary day. Got blood on my skirt. And early in the 90s, I started developing some symptoms. I felt tired, felt cold. And being a nurse, I tried to diagnose myself, thinking I had thyroid disease. But it turns out that I ended up seeing a hepatologist, and I was diagnosed with non-B hepatitis, which eventually was, the name was changed to hepatitis C. Mm. And hepatitis C is a powerful virus that destroys the liver. And just so you know, the virus can live outside of the body for 4 hours and in a moist environment for 2 weeks.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a lot of people don't.
Yeah, there's a lot of people living with that too, yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of people living with it, and unfortunately, many of those people don't even know or are aware that they have it. Mm. So I was treated at the time with the standard treatment, which was interferon and ribavirin, and that had a lot of side effects, which you have to deal with, mm-hmm. and a lot of people weren't compliant with it. I was very compliant with it. I was taking it off and on for about 10 years, but unfortunately, I was a non-responder. So over the years, my virus was destroying my liver, and it became inflamed, it became fibrotic, and then I developed cirrhosis, which is irregular scarring of the liver and affects other body systems from functioning normally. Yeah. And I just want to give you, for your information, there are 100 different causes of cirrhosis besides hepatitis C, including non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is actually the number one cause of cirrhosis. And that's becoming a lot more prevalent because of the increased obesity in this country and people not paying attention to what they put in their bodies.
Right. So you came to the point where, as you say, your liver is failing and you realize that you've got, in order to live, you're going to have a liver transplant. 2 years you were on the list?
Well, yes, because, let me just back up a little bit. Mm-hmm. During these years, you can feel really normal. The meds cause the most side effects, and many people don't even know if their liver is sick until you reach the final stage of cirrhosis. Mm-hmm. And in the fall of 2010, I started developing some symptoms. I became short of breath, and I was taken to the hospital, and it was determined that I had a quart of fluid around my lungs. Oh, so boy. I was transferred to a major hospital, and that was the beginning of all of my problems. I had many thoracentesis, which is a needle that is put into the sac around my lung to drain. Mm. And everybody's probably a little bit more familiar with ascites, which is the fluid that builds up around your abdomen. Mm. I didn't have that. I had the fluid around my lungs. Mm. So then what happened was in the winter of 2010 and 2011, I was worked up at a hospital for a liver transplant, and I was evaluated by everybody mm-hmm. from the cardiologist to the psychiatrist, and I was approved for a transplant. I was put on the list.
Yeah.
But livers and other organs are sometimes hard to come by in New England.
Yeah. Claudette has arrived.
I can imagine that this 2-year wait. I mean, what a, you know, you're dealing with all of the symptoms of you know the disease, and then you have no idea if you're going to live long enough to see this transplant. That had to be a terribly nerve-wracking time for you.
It was. You become very, very anxious, but you have to have a positive attitude. Yeah. You know, you have to think positive. You try to do the best that you can. It's great to have a great support system, which I had, mm-hmm. and I just tried to keep interested in things, and I exercised. I just wanted to get better, try
yeah,
to get better.
Of course.
But then what happened was in the spring of 2011, I was admitted to the hospital, and I had many admissions after that yeah. in that spring, in and out of the hospital. And in the summer of 2011, I became so short of breath I couldn't even walk from the bedroom to the bathroom. Mm. I forgot things. I couldn't do activities of daily living. I have no memory of this because I developed high ammonia levels and had encephalopathy of the brain.
Mm, wow.
And so all that happened from this summer to when I got better, I have no memory of
wow,
it.
That's amazing.
I was really out of it.
Yeah. And Claudette Gibson also joins us now. Good morning, Claudette.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Now, it was December of 2012 that you guys met for the first time. Laurel, tell us about how you and Claudette actually came to meet each other. How does that work?
Okay, well, after I had my transplant, I when I got home, about 6 months after I got home and feeling better again, I was very anxious to contact Claudette and thank her and offer her my sympathy for losing her son. And she saved her son, saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
So the Southern Alliance is equivalent to our New England Organ Bank,
mm-hmm.
and it's in the Florida region. So I wrote her a note through the Southern Alliance. It was anonymous, and they forwarded it on to Claudette. And then Claudette and I were able to write back and forth to each other anonymously. We could give them general information, but we couldn't say where we lived or what our names were.
Mm-hmm.
And after a period of time, they determined that we were prepared to communicate with each other, which we did by phone. And then we set up a time to meet, and which we did in December in Daytona Beach, Florida.
Mm. And what was that like for you, Laurel?
It was so overwhelming. I can remember being in the hotel room, and Claudette and her daughter were coming. They said they're in the lobby, and just standing in the hallway waiting for them to come up. I was just beside myself. I can't even describe it. It's like 100 Christmases, but a lot of sort of anxiety too.
Right.
I felt, you know, you feel a little bit guilty because,
right.
you know, here I am living and her son is dead
yeah.
and I have his organs. So I was very conflicted in how I felt, but all I know was that I wanted to hug her and tell her thank you for what she did.
Claudette, first let me say I'm so sorry about your son's death, but tell us from your perspective as you're meeting Laurel what it was like for you.
Well, it was mixed emotions. It was a feeling of I was going to be able to see a part of AJ, you know, that I had for almost, over a year I had said goodbye to. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I was, I was going to come face to face with someone that actually had a part of him and wanted to meet us. So it was mixed.
Yeah.
And when I first saw her, it was like seeing him, mm-hmm. Like she described. It's a weird situation.
Yeah.
I don't think words can explain it. Mm-hmm. I think it's an experience. Lauren and I, we talk and have talked lots of times since then, try to explain, certain emotions. She have some overwhelming feelings sometimes to pick up the telephone and call me. Mm-hmm. It's just eerie. It's weird.
Tell us about AJ.
AJ was the love of my life. He was young, vibrant, just finished high school, and he was kind of like my protector, my friend, and only a biological son, and we were very close. It's still a very difficult topic to talk about. Losing him.
Sure.
But looking across at Laurel, she looks wonderful. She looks great. Mm-hmm. Knowing where she came from, that gives me strength to know that I've done the right thing. I've mm-hmm. helped her. I couldn't help AJ, and mm-hmm. that was what helped me make a decision. There was nothing I could do for AJ at the time.
Six other individuals also benefited from AJ's organs. And have you met any of them? Is Laurel the only one that you've met of the people that AJ was able to help?
Yes. Laurel is the only one. I have communicated with one of the recipient of one of his kidneys, but mm-hmm. That was it. Laurel is... Yeah. Has his heart in a way.
Yeah,
I keep. We often joke about it. They say the heart is where the home is, but for AJ and Laurel, it is the liver.
Yeah. Now, of course, you never expect your child to die before you do. So, but was this a organ donation anything you had ever discussed with AJ?
No. Quite strangely, no. Yeah. But my background is nursing. I'm a registered nurse midwife. So I do know a lot about the benefits of organ mm-hmm. donation. I've worked where I've seen, persons on the list mm-hmm. waiting and hoping for an opportunity and that opportunity not coming in time. So, I was aware of the good that mm-hmm. an organ donation can do.
So describe then how this decision was made. I mean, because you're in it's a terrible time. You're not expecting this. He's 18 years old. And as you know, time is of the essence. You have to make these decisions quickly. So what went into that decision for you? Was it conversations with folks at the hospital? I mean, how did you go about making that decision?
It was a moment that came to me during my grief. I felt that, my whole world had caved in. I've lost my son of 18 years. He had just finished school, and he was so full of life. I reflected on the Friday evening before he got ill. We were together for, a greater part of the evening, and we joked around, and he was always making me laugh. Mm-hmm. And there he was, lying on the bed. He looked normal, mm-hmm. looked like everything was okay. And the doctors were saying to me that he will never be the same again. So mm-hmm. it was just an awful feeling, and it's through that grief striking moment, I thought, well, I can't help AJ, but I certainly would like to try to help, as many persons as I can by doing this donation.
Right. And Claudette and Laura, you are both in Boston to help raise awareness about liver disease. And it really some startling statistics. According to the American Liver Foundation, liver disease affects 1 in 10 U.S. residents. But 70% of those living with liver disease, as you were mentioning earlier, Laura, are unaware of their illness. That's kind of an alarming statistic when you think about that.
It is. Up to 5.4 million Americans have chronic hepatitis B or C. And about 65 to 75% of the infected population are unaware that they are infected with the viruses. Yeah. That is sad because mm-hmm. we need to detect the virus so that people can become cured.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking with Laura Welch and Claudette Gibson. We're talking about organ donation. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. We'll talk more after a short break.
And this is WCAI. Support comes from you and from Katuit Solar, an official solar energy system installer for the Solarize Bourne Initiative, sponsored by the town and the state. The sign-up period for Bourne residents and business owners ends September 30th. Information at katuitsolar.com.
You never get lost in Cape Cod, really, but you know the dune shacks in the province lands? Well, there's these old, they're kind of fishermen shacks that are now historic. They're off the grid. They're back in the dunes. At one point, I was invited out to one of the shacks. It was winter. It was nighttime. I went out well after dark. There was a blizzard going on, and I brought a friend. And we're walking through the dunes in a blizzard, trying to cover your face from the biting ice that's being blown. And we're walking through the dunes, and you think, yeah, you can never get lost here. But then suddenly I realized that the lighthouse light was coming from the wrong direction.
Cartographer Mark Adams. In Truro.
But actually, I have a lousy sense of direction.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about organ donation. And joining us this morning, Laura Welch, who received a liver transplant. Claudette Gibson, who is the mother of AJ Gibson, whose liver now resides in Laurel and saved her life. Laurel, you were mentioning earlier, you talked about, the stages of what happened with your liver disease and early detection becoming key, because the liver can regenerate and repair itself as long as it hasn't become too scarred. But early stages of liver disease aren't generally noticeable, as you were mentioning. So who should be screened for liver disease and how often?
Well, I think anybody that has any risk factors, IV drug use, tattoos, people who have had exposure to blood from, you see somebody with a bloody nose and you have cuts on your hand, mm-hmm. you touch that blood without gloves, you're at risk. Mm. People in the baby boomer generation are at risk for various reasons. How you get tested is you would talk to your doctor mm-hmm. about it and ask if he thinks it's appropriate for you to be tested.
Yeah, you said something. I could see some ears perking when you said tattoos. They're very popular right now. And a lot of young people, I think, probably don't even, that doesn't even cross their mind as they're getting tattooed. But that is a big risk factor.
It is, because I'm sure most tattoo parlors, I've never been in one, but I understand the process. And you have to make sure that those needles have never been used before.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If they've, or autoclaved properly, and I mean properly. So you are at risk if you have tattoos, and I would recommend that you get tested.
Yeah. We're going to bring Richard Luskin into the conversation. He's the president and CEO of the New England Organ Bank. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Can you explain the role of the New England Organ Bank and how that works in the organ donations?
Sure. The United States has an organized system for the recovery of organs from deceased donors. There are 58 what are known generically as organ procurement organizations, or OPOs, around the country, each one serving a specific geographic region of the country. New England Organ Bank covers most of the New England, six-state New England area. And we are all linked together in a national system that's called the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network. And everybody who is actually waiting for an organ at any transplant center in any part of the country is on a large national list that is maintained by the OPTN. Mm-hmm. And there are also requirements from the hospitals to notify their local OPO whenever there is a patient who might be in the circumstances where they could be potentially be an organ donor. Mm. And they then, once we're notified or one of our sister organizations around the country, we respond to the hospital and make an assessment of whether or not the patient actually is a potential donor. And then if they are, continue by talking with families, mm-hmm. Such as Claudette's, mm-hmm. and seeking to obtain consent to go ahead with the procedure.
Yeah.
The other thing that happens, and we would certainly encourage this, is that many people now actually register their desires to be an organ and tissue donor mm-hmm. when they're alive, and they do so most typically when they go to renew their driver's license. And there are registries in each of the states which record your interest in being a donor. Across the country, we're somewhere between 45% and 50% of the folks in the U.S. have actually signed up already. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it obviously makes it a lot easier for the family. They know what their loved one's wishes were, and we can then help them carry that out.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the responsibility falls on the surviving family members. And as you said earlier, it's a very difficult time, mm-hmm. very emotional. Yeah. They've lost a loved one. And then you're being asked to make a fairly large decision in trying to figure out what would your loved one have wanted. Yeah. So we certainly encourage everyone to sign up in advance and make their wishes known.
So many questions I've got now for you, Richard. Let me just start with that, with the people who sign up with the driver's licenses. You still need consent from the family. So, I say, yes, on my driver's license, I'd like to be an organ donor. But realistically, you really need to let your family also know that you've done that. Right? Because, I mean, that's just signing on your license isn't the end of the story.
Well, we certainly encourage you to tell your family that you've done that because you should. Yeah. But the fact is that when you sign up on the registry, that is legal consent. And we do not need the additional consent of the family at all. In fact, the way the laws are written, it specifically says the family cannot override your wish as expressed.
Oh, that's good to know.
On the registry. So it's that's somewhat of a change from what existed some years ago. So I'm not surprised that what your impression was.
Yeah.
But within the last 5 to 10 years, as the registries have grown in the U.S., they really are what we refer to as a legal consent registry as opposed to a registry of one's intent.
So let me ask you this then, since that it's the law, you don't need the family's consent. Do you still go and talk to the family what's going to happen? Oh, you do. Okay.
Of course. Yeah. No, it's you really, obviously, this is there's a whole lot that's going to happen, and you can't just whisk off somebody and do that. We spend a lot of time with the family, and we have the same conversation we would have with the family if we're approaching them for consent to explain what's going to happen, how long it's going to take, and so on and so forth. Yeah. So, of course, the family is involved in that discussion.
And as you mentioned, this is a really difficult time for the families, and especially when you can see where there'd be some hesitation. They don't want to let go of this loved one, and it's so emotional. How do you have those conversations? I imagine that's really difficult for your staff to, somebody go in there and say, oh, by the way, can we talk to you for a minute about, your loved one's organs and tissue?
Yes, I have to tell you, I don't do it personally, and I couldn't do it personally, mm-hmm. but we have some extremely skilled people on our staff, most of whom are actually master's prepared social workers mm-hmm. or intensive care nurses who've been specially trained to do this kind of conversation. And there are it's really an art mm-hmm. because you're, in a sense, trying to support the person who's the family members who've lost the loved one. But you're also trying to get to an endpoint, which is a decision and a discussion and moving on. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of time supporting the family. as well as, in fact, explaining what might happen and how it's going to happen in the time frame.
Yeah.
And it's frequently family members of donors become fairly attached to members of our staff mm-hmm. with whom they develop a fairly close relationship based on having had that discussion at such a difficult time.
Yeah. One thing we should also mention is the organ donation. This is it's treated this surgically. And a lot of people go, oh, but I don't want my, you know, loved one to, you know, be in this condition of, you know, like you're taking all the organs. This is as if they went in for surgery. I mean, it's kind of a difficult thing to talk about, but the body is intact.
Well, it's not as if, it is in fact.
Yeah.
Done in an operating room with the same care as anyone who would be living. Because if you think about it, we need to recover the organ in a way that it can be reused. So obviously it's done with a lot of care and delicacy and so on. And we spend a lot of time working on that. There's probably not seen by the family, but there's a lot of respect for the deceased. Usually there's a few moments of silence before the recovery begins. Sometimes we've actually, in cases where we ask the family to write a few words about their loved one, and it's read by one of our staff members in the operating room before the team gets started.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a bit of a sense of who they're, who the patient is or was, really, because
right.
they're dead, obviously, who the patient was. So there's a sense that this is something very special.
Yeah. If you have questions for our guests, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. And Richard, Joel would like to know if there is an age limit for organ and tissue donors.
On a practical basis, we will consider clinically appropriate patients up to the age of 80.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously not for every organ
right.
and not every person, but one of the things you discover, there are 75-year-old people who have taken really good care of themselves and are fortunate genetically or whatever, and there are 25-year-old people who aren't mm-hmm. in such good shape.
Right.
So it's not a matter of age. And in fact, one of the issues that comes up with the registry is that people say, oh, well, I support organ donation, but I won't put myself on the registry because I'm too old or mm-hmm. I have this medical problem or whatever. And we really encourage people not to rule themselves out because it really is a decision based on what is going on with them medically at the time they die.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they can't donate 7 organs, as happened in this case, maybe they can donate a liver.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the liver is one of the more resilient organs that you can recover from somebody who's in their 70s and successfully transplant. And it may make the difference of saving a life, as it did with Laurel.
Yeah.
And you just don't say, I won't be a donor because I'm too old, because
right.
you probably aren't.
All right. John is giving us a call from Dennis. Good morning, John.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, John.
It's kind of a clinical question. My dad was a pathologist, and I grew up in a morgue. That was my hobby. And I'm wondering why is the pancreas not transplanted with the liver? You know what I mean.
Yeah,
if you
okay.
can address that question,
sure.
I'll take your answer off the air.
Right, thanks, John. Richard, do you know the answer to that?
Well, I'm not a physician or a surgeon, but I would say you only transplant the organs that absolutely need to be replaced. And there's not necessarily a correlation between having liver failure and having mm-hmm. pancreas failure.
Okay.
Pancreas are transplanted more typically for people who have suffered significant damage to the kidney and the pancreas as a result of having diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not usually linked to a liver transplant.
Okay. Let's talk about the list of those in need of organ donations. The New England Organ Bank is not the keeper, the creator of this list, as you mentioned earlier. So how does that list work? You mentioned there's all these the different agencies across the country, and you have this one list. So is need, I mean, do you go to the top of the list if your need is greater than somebody else's? How does that list work?
So patients are actually listed by their transplant physician or surgeon at the individual transplant center. So we don't, the organ procurement organizations don't get involved in who is listed. The OPTN creates part of its responsibility, and this is working on behalf of the federal government. They're on a contract to actually create priorities for who will go first. It's not an easy process because it's the one area of medicine where we – it doesn't matter how much money there is or how many things you could manufacture. We simply don't have enough organs. Mm-hmm. So you have to create priorities. And depending on the organ, the priorities vary, but it's a combination of a variety of things. It's waiting time, how long have you been on the list, how sick you are. And how sick you are translates into, depending on the organ, trying to answer the question, how likely are you to continue to live? In other words, how likely, mm-hmm. likely are you to die in the near future? And how likely is a transplant in you to be successful in the future? There's also, there are issues of ABO blood typing, so you can't put a B organ into an O recipient because it would be rejected. There are issues for some organs like liver and lungs and heart. There are issues of size. Mm-hmm. You can't take a heart from a 300-pound man and put it in a 10-year-old child. It mm-hmm. simply won't fit.
Right.
So that creates – all of these factors go into creating a priority and – for instance, in the lung, there's something called a lung allocation score, which is a clinical calculation based on various laboratory values. In the liver, there's something known as the MELD, which is a similar kind of calculation, which attempts to rank patients based on how sick they are. Mm-hmm. It's not a perfect system, and there are always so many more candidates than there are available organs. Mm-hmm. When we actually have a donor, we put the donor's information into this national computer system, so their age and their size and their blood type and so on. And we get a printed computerized list and we work our way down the list. Mm. We call the transplant centers, describe the donor. Their recipient perhaps is sick that day so they can't be transplanted, but sick with something other than their right. disease that's requiring them to be transplanted, or they don't perhaps, you know, the clinical condition of the donor they don't think is appropriate for their recipient. Mm-hmm. But we work our way down the list. It's a very carefully audited system. Every donor is audited at the national level to make sure that we're following the rules and yeah. so on. But so we don't get to make any individual decisions about who gets the organ.
Yeah, I was just curious how it worked. And then, of course, time is of the essence, of course. Like you're saying, if somebody isn't prepared yes. for that surgery that day, you go the next likely person on the list because it's got to happen right now, right?
Yes. There is a time process. Obviously, we do a lot of testing of the donor to make sure, just going back to your earlier conversation, to make sure the donor, for example, doesn't have hepatitis C mm-hmm. or hepatitis B or HIV or any of the other diseases that might be transmitted, because that can, in fact, rule them out as a potential donor.
Right.
And then we have to do all the logistics to arrange the surgical teams, get them to the actual hospital where the recovery is going to happen and so mm-hmm. on. But generally, it's an 18 to 24-hour process from mm-hmm. the time we begin it until the organs are actually recovered, yeah. sometimes faster, yeah. sometimes a little slower, but that's about average.
Okay. David is giving us a call from Nantucket. Hi, David.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I had a liver transplant a little over four years ago at Mass General, and a couple of things that I noticed. I'll put it this way: nobody mentioned the fact that a lot of people that get Hep C got it from sharing straws, snorting drugs. Mm. That's sort of something that my doctors have now said that just they're finding that they think that's a pretty common way to get it.
Hmm.
I got it back when I was a kid, and I got it from a transfusion in a hospital. But and it lay dormant until I didn't know I had it until I was in my early 50s.
Wow.
And the other thing that was mentioned about not transplanting people organs that have diseases. Actually, they do occasionally do it with people that are in real dire straits and that are, you know, on the cusp of dying. One of the guys I met at Mass General, it didn't happen. He got lucky, but as it turned out, they were going to give him a liver from somebody who had AIDS because he was within a day of dying, and they felt that they could actually, I mean, in a way, you can actually treat AIDS with drugs better in some cases than you can Hep C, although that's about to change. They're coming up with some really good treatments for Hep C now.
Yeah. David, thanks for the call. And, of course, Richard, I don't know if you want to respond to what David is saying.
I would say, actually, there at the moment, there is a specific law that forbids the use of organs from anybody who has HIV, mm-hmm. AIDS. So we would not be transplanting. I'm not sure
when that happened,
where that story happened. But there is, in fact, at the moment, an attempt to rethink that, because there are many patients who have AIDS and are being treated, in a sense, as a chronic disease now, who might benefit from getting an organ from someone who dies who also had AIDS. So you're not infecting them with something they don't already have.
Yeah.
But we can't do that. And there are – but the caller's general point that there's an assessment made of each donor and recipient match is accurate. And, in fact, on occasion, a donor with hepatitis C – will, in fact, be liver will be used to transplant a patient who also has hepatitis C. So it's part of the assessment process. But in general, those organs are tend not to be used.
Right. And we commonly think of, you know, kidney, liver, and even heart and lung transplants. But there's also a need for bone and tissue transplants, right? Describe how that's used.
Well, yes, as you say, most people think of it as organs, but in fact, there are many, many more tissue transplants and many more tissue donors than there are organ donors. The bone is used for a variety of things. When you have a hip replacement, bone chips are actually used as part of that surgery. Patients who require a heart valve replacement, you can get a mechanical valve or a valve that actually comes from a pig. But there are, in fact, many clinical indications where a human heart valve is the most appropriate thing. Skin is used for a variety of things. Most people think of it as a temporary dressing in patients who've had a severe burn. Probably the most common or among the most common tissue transplants is a corneal transplant. So you can actually restore sight to somebody who is blind by giving them a corneal transplant.
Amazing.
So
yeah.
it's a very, 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 very common thing.
Right. We're talking about.
I also should, if I could comment on one of the things that the caller mentioned about transfusions. He's correct. Before, as Laurel said earlier, there was a time when there wasn't an awareness of the viruses that could be transmitted by transfusions. But in the last 25 years or so, all the blood has been very carefully screened, which is why they're fairly careful about who they will take as a blood donor. So blood transfusion transmissions don't really happen anymore, but they did in an earlier time, and as your caller described, the virus may lie dormant for a long
time. That was amazing. He said it happened when he was a kid and didn't have any symptoms till he was in his 50s. That's amazing. We are talking about organ donation. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break.
Science Minute.
There's a quote I really love. It's by Marcel Proust. It says, "The true voyage of discovery is not so much in seeking new landscapes as in having new eyes."
Oceanographer Dave Gallo of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
And the way I interpret that is that technology has given us this wonderful ability to have new eyes. It's the same planet. It's the same ocean. But by looking at it a little bit differently, we're starting to think differently about the way we live on Earth. Think about it. With a telescope, you can pretty much see eternity, the infinite, looking out into space. With a microscope today, you can look into materials and look at the infinitesimal, So we've got that covered. And with computers, you can take something very fast, a lightning bolt. You can stop it in midair, walk around it in three dimensions, and study it. So that's what we can do with our technology as humans. You know, we can look down on the Earth from space. And yet, despite all that, despite knowing all the challenges that are coming to us about this population living on this planet, we still act like idiots.
You're listening to WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about organ donation with Richard Luskin, the president and CEO of the New England Organ Bank. Also joining us is Laura Welch, who received a liver transplant, and Claudette Gibson, the mother of the organ donor. Are the best candidates for organ donations those individuals who die unexpectedly, not from an illness, or are they equal? I know you analyze each case differently, but generally speaking.
Well, I think most people think about the typical organ donor as being the victim, a young person who's the victim of a trauma, a car accident, or a blow to the head. And certainly that is, in some ways, the donors that may be able to provide the most organs and the best organs. But that's not necessarily so. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a very significant percentage of the donors actually come from people who have had a stroke or a bleed and become brain dead. In other words, there's no more, there's no more functioning brain. They're being maintained heart rate and ventilation artificially on a ventilator. And they are actually the majority of donors. And so they're not necessarily young trauma victims.
Right. We should also mention that in some cases, you don't have to die to donate. I mean, I know somebody who donated a lung lobe and another one who donated a kidney, a part of a liver. So that's another thing. That's a very generous person who steps up and does that for complete strangers. Bone marrow, right?
Yes. We don't get involved in the bone marrow because that's a much less invasive surgery. But in terms of kidney is the most common living form of living donation. You have two kidneys and you can do quite well with one kidney. And in fact, the initial thought really of anybody who has kidney failure and is in need of a transplant is to look to family and friends first for somebody who might be a donor. Obviously, a kidney from a healthy living person under controlled circumstances is almost always, or I should say on average, better than a kidney from a deceased person. Living liver donation and living lung donation is less common. It involves taking a portion of the lung or a portion of the liver. And it is done, and especially in livers with kids, because they can the liver, as you mentioned earlier, is quite a remarkable organ. If you take a portion of a donated liver and you put it in a recipient within a very short period of time, a month or so, it actually grows to full size. It's
amazing.
Quite an amazing thing. So yes, living lung donors are pretty infrequent, but they do happen occasionally.
Yeah, Laurel, I wanted to ask you, following your liver transplant. You know, we always hear stories. Some people come through it flying colors, no problems. Others sometimes have rejections or other issues. What was your case like? Did you heal quickly and without any other troubles?
Well, I think I'm a little bit of a different case because I was so sick when I went in for my liver transplant, and I have no memory of this, and due to encephalopathy. I was at the hospital in Miami at Jackson Memorial Hospital for 2 months, and I had to learn how to walk and learn to function again. But I want to reassure the audience that isn't necessarily the case. Matter of fact, there are a lot of patients in the hospital where I was that came in for a scheduled liver transplant, and they left in a week.
Wow.
So people should not be scared about that.
Yeah.
Mine was a little bit of an exceptional case.
Yeah, exactly. Richard, as parents, we don't want to think about our children dying before we do, but unfortunately it does happen, as was the case with AJ. But then we have smaller children, younger children, who are also on a waiting list for organ donations. Is it more difficult to find donor matches for children?
Well, yes, and it's particularly for the liver and the heart and the lungs, and it's a matter of size. Mm-hmm. The good news is there aren't a lot of pediatric donors. There aren't a lot of small kids who become donors, and that's in every way other than someone who's waiting for a transplant. Right. That's, of course, great
good,
news.
Yeah.
So it is harder to find organs for very small children. For kidneys, the way the national system is set up, because kids need functioning kidneys to develop normally and they don't do as well on dialysis as adults, the system actually prioritizes kids. So the best kidneys, in a sense, are offered preferentially to children, and kids don't wait very long for a kidney. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing we've been able to do on a national system. But it does create issues, mm-hmm. always about, you know, kids are a dying child is photogenic and heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we have to remember that there is a system and that there are just as many heartbreaking stories of adults who are waiting right. for organs as well.
Yeah. We talked earlier, Laurel and Claudet, about your meeting, an organ recipient and family member of an organ donor making contact. Richard, is that common?
We actually facilitate quite a few meetings between donor families and recipients. It's a very personal thing. Some recipients have no interest in doing that. Mm-hmm. Some donor families have absolutely no interest in doing that. So the process that Laurel described of writing to each other anonymously first mm-hmm. and beginning to get to know each other is really the same process we would use. And if it seems like it would be a good idea and the families both want to do it, then we help facilitate that. Mm-hmm. In fact, when we started doing this about 20 years ago, it was one of those things that people thought was going to be a terrible idea. It was mm-hmm. a very paternalistic view of this, that in fact, you should never allow donors and donor families and recipients to meet. But our experience is that if it's done after a sort of a warm-up period of getting to know each other anonymously, it almost always goes well.
Yeah.
And it's the story that you heard, I've heard told by so many families about this sort of trepidation and then this this wonderful attraction and caring for each other that that you've heard Laurel and Claudette describe.
Yeah, I like the way Laurel said it's like 100 Christmases. Claudette, and I know that you said you've had some, letters or emails with another of the recipients of one of AJ's organs. But after such a positive experience with Laurel, are you a little nervous about meeting any of the other? I mean, because not everyone would turn out that great, I would think.
yes, because you never know, right. you know, who has or you know, how anyone can be from
yeah.
time to time.
Right.
But I'm not, I'm not reaching out to anyone mm-hmm. that has gotten any of his organs. What I'm able to do is I check from time to time. With the organ league in Florida,
mm-hmm.
and you know, just to check to see, okay, how is the recipient of AJ's heart?
Oh, good. They let you know that. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
and they would
good.
Say, well, yeah, you know.
Yeah. So you sort of can keep tabs without actually
yeah.
having to know who these people are.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, yeah. Laurel mentioned that she reached out because she really wanted to say thank you to AJ for saving his life and let you know that. What went into your decision to meet with Laurel? Why did you decide to do that?
Well, it was a bit of closure for me. I wanted to actually experience and see what had happened with the gift.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted some closure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, meeting her was, it did that.
Right. And then, so you said you can see AJ sort of living on in Laurel, but you've also
yes.
set up a scholarship in his name. So tell us about the scholarship.
Right. Well, the scholarship was set up because I wanted to kind of keep his memory alive He was a very giving person. He would take the shirt off his back, so to speak, to give to someone else. And he was a typical a male child in high school, not doing homework. You know, it was a challenge to get him to complete his schoolwork. But he would always promise me, he said, you know, I'm going to surprise you, Mommy. And, you know, we, at his last year in school, we have like external examination so that you can get into colleges. And he actually did 13 subjects and he got 11, all at A and B, which was shocking for me. You know, it. So in memory of him, I wanted to set up this fund so that, A, it will give parents who have children, you know, who are not very interested at the age that AJ was, the opportunity to do some good, like surprising their parents. Okay, I'm doing good in school, so I can get the scholarship and take the pressure off you having to send me to school, that sort of thing. And in all of this, it helps me with the memory that I'm continuing the legacy of AJ in helping someone.
Yes, and he's living on in so many people's lives in so many different ways. Yes. Claudette Gibson, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Laura Welch, thank you. And also Richard Luskin, President and CEO of New England Organ Bank. Thank you all for joining us and sharing your stories with us this morning. We appreciate that.
Thanks for having us.
I also want to thank Margaret Carsley and John Parker for production assistance in Boston. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.